What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Juan Hernandez is the founder and CEO of Open Finance Network. In this conversation, we discuss the current state of digital securities, the quality of assets being tokenized today, and the challenges facing the industry moving forward. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Bang, bang. What's going on, guys? We've got Juan here. A nice early morning on a Friday, rainy in New York City. Thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
How are things going?
Good. You know, a lot of what we're seeing on the marketplace is just this level of growing excitement for digitized securities. The ability to take these existing alternative assets or New York's alternative assets, be able to tokenize them, expose them to a broader universe of participants and investors, both in the US and worldwide. And so a lot of that momentum is just slowly building up and picking up steam across the board.
Cool. Before we get into kind of a state of the digital security ecosystem, maybe let's go through your background, because you obviously weren't in crypto early on and kind of backed into this in a very unique way. So just kind of where you start your career and then we can get into how you actually discovered all this.
Yeah. So quick background on me. So I have a computer science degree from Northwestern University. Did software consulting for a while, went back to business school to get my MBA at Kellogg, and then just started doing entrepreneurship, just started doing startups in 2010. And so had a couple of small startups, one small exit, and then in 2014 started what is now Open Finance, which at the time we were focused on, this was before crypto. So it was pre-crypto, alternative assets, building out a trading platform for these alternative assets. And the crux of it was at the time crowdfunding was really getting started, really going. And for us, we looked at that industry and said, okay, where is the next challenge for this sector? And what's the next hurdle they have to overcome in order for the industry to really grow? And for us, that was the issue of liquidity. So what happens after you buy one of these crowdfunded securities, people expect to be able to move around to them like they do with a Google or a Microsoft stock, and that just wasn't possible at the time. And so we built a trading platform. We acquired a broker-dealer, built a trading platform for trading of alternative assets, and we're doing that successfully, expanded into publicly registered non-listed REITs as well, which is an instrument in between private REITs and then the more traditional publicly registered, publicly listed REITs that you see on NASDAQ or NYSE. And then from there in 2016, much like every other financial exchange, we started looking at blockchain for clearing and settlement solutions, for efficiencies on the clearing and settlement side. Started playing with that late 2016. And then 2017 hit, right? The big ICO craze, if you will. And from that big boom and craze, what we saw emerge was this new form of capital raising mechanism in these tokenized offerings, but we knew that they were securities, and we knew that once the dust settled, if you will, that they would be classified as securities. And so we began positioning ourselves to be able to take advantage of that coming wave of security tokens or digitized securities or tokenized securities, whatever you want to call them. And so we worked on that throughout 2017. And then in 2018, we did launch our digital trading platform and have been going ever since. And so we work with tokenized securities like Blockchain Capital and several others that are out there today.
Awesome. So here's what I want to do. I want to go through kind of the current state of digital securities, right? Whether you call them tokenized securities, digital securities, smart securities, I mean, there's all these different names for them. But what we're essentially talking about is a digital form or digitally native security that is programmable, et cetera, right?
Yeah, it's the format right now. I mean, and so that, you know, couple things to talk about there. Like, obviously, let's circle back on like terminology and the lexicon of these types of instruments, because I think that's one of the things that is it's a hindrance right now in the industry, because a lot of people just use these different terminologies, and there's some nuances. They might mean different things, but yeah, I mean, to your point, these are just securities. At least today, these are securities in a new and improved format. So, So you know, we went from paper certificates to electronic certificates, and now we're going to these digital certificates, digital securities.
Mm-hmm. And so as part of this, I think, in my opinion, right, we need issuance platforms, we need protocols, we need exchanges, we need accounting, we need legal, right? We need regulatory clarity.
That's a lot.
Right?
That's
all
a lot.
This stuff. Let's just start with issuance platforms, right? So describe to me what you think the issuance platforms, what's their importance to the industry? And let's just kind of talk through, like, where are we with issuance platforms today?
Yeah, I think issuance platforms for us serve one huge primary role right now. And it's not actual just issuance, it's actually education. To us, they're the ones that are going out there, reaching out to the issuers, doing the advocacy of why you should tokenize, why you should move to this digitized or tokenized format. They get a lot of inbound right now. I think there's a lot of interest from new issuers who want to take advantage of this capital raising technique. But I think a lot of what we see the better ones do is reach out to more traditional issuers and try to really espouse the benefits of why you want to do this tokenized format. And so for us, that's a big, they're obviously bringing in a lot of the flow, a lot of the influx of new assets that are able to then trade on the secondary market like ours.
Got it. And as we move through this, I think that there are various levels of kind of maturity with each aspect. If you had to give a grade, right? So A, B, C, you can do plus or minuses, like we're in school. Issuance platforms today as a whole ecosystem alone, A plus, B minus, where are we in terms of just like how sophisticated they are?
Yeah, I think as a whole, I'd give them a gentleman's C.
A gentleman C. Yeah. Okay. All right. And what do you think the biggest challenges are right now that like, what do we have to do to get from a C to an A minus?
I say that only because, you know, to be fair, also, you know, we're in a tough market right now. I mean, across the board, the crypto markets have gone soft, crypto winter, extended or whatever you want to call it. And so their job is very challenging right now because you have perhaps a lot of exciting new exotic offerings that are trying to raise money in this market. And they're not really able to do so just because the market itself is very soft. And also because these are very exotic offerings that might not be appealing to a broader audience. For the more traditional assets, more traditional issuers that might want to participate, they see the softness in the overall crypto markets and they say, well, is now really the right time, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps last year, just with all the frothy and the frenziness, I think you would get a lot more traditional issuers to dip their toe in the water because they just want to be a part of that movement. But now since it's cooled off a bit to a certain extent, that's made their jobs a lot more difficult. And so I say a gentleman's C, you know, only because it just as a whole, I think there are a lot of macro level issues that are playing against successful capital raises in today's market.
And what do you think the timeline is for some of that to improve? You think it's really just market dependent in terms of if we can get some price stabilization and maybe even some recovery, a lot of that gets alleviated? Or do you think this is something where, we probably have a 2-year timeline and we just need time for people to build technology?
I don't know that it's a technology hurdle right now. I think it's more, it's a institutional level adoption hurdle, right? You work a lot with your institutional partners and you have a sense of where the appetite is. And people are starting to dip their toes into water across a variety of instruments, right? And so you've got pension funds who are starting to allocate capital to firms such as yours. You've got you see the Fidelities of the world, the Goldman Sachs of the world start to slowly creep in a little bit, starting with Bitcoin or something. And so once you have enough of those larger scale participants starting to throw their weight in, then I think that's going to bring that more mid-level tier institutional players who see now that there is a validation to a certain extent. This isn't this scary, exotic crypto world anymore. It's more of just this new form of capital raising, this new form of asset management. And then you'll start to see a lot of them say, okay, is there an opportunity for me to, let's say, you know, they're doing a new billion dollar raise for whatever instrument they're working on. Perhaps there's an opportunity to carve out a little sidecar, 100 mil, 50 something, and try one of these tokenized paths and see how that works out. And it's low risk to them in a sense of it's just a sidecar to their main vehicle. So that, I think, probably by year's end.
Okay.
I don't think it's a 2-year thing. I think there's we're having a lot of conversations with some of the institutional level folks who want to see a bit more validation in the market before they decide to, okay, you know, let's try a little pilot, if you will.
Got it.
What do you think about the protocols? Right. So where are we with protocols? What's kind of the state of the union? too many protocols.
Too many.
Okay.
And so it was just speaking at an event yesterday at the Harvard Club here, and we talked specifically about this, right? There's every single issuance platform out there has their own little protocol layer. And for us, as we interface with all of these partners, and so we've had a chance to review a lot of the protocols. And quite frankly, a lot of them do very similar things. And so to us, that's not a differentiator for an issuance platform. You have to provide an additional level of service and products on top of that protocol. If all you have is a protocol layer, you're not really offering much to your clients. And so the protocols, they're all starting to really sort of synthesize into, I think soon we'll just be able to, as an industry, almost take a vote and just decide, okay, we're going to pick this open source format and everyone's just going to adopt it because that's going to be better for everyone. And so even today, these are open source standards. And so you can see how certain protocols are very similar to other protocols, just with slightly different tweaks here.
Will there be consolidation, you think, where literally they kind of all just say, all right, this one, you know, option A is the most effective, efficient, and best to move forward with, and let's all just use that?
Yeah. And the thing is, you've got folks that are putting their names on protocols, which is just no one's going to adopt the competitor's protocol if it has their name on it. So we advocate a lot for just kind of trying to push forward just a brandless, if you will, protocol that everyone can agree to. Is there one
that you have in mind as like, this should be the one?
We're looking at a couple of the EIPs out there. Haven't necessarily seen one that's all encompassing yet. But internally, we have this thing called S3, a smart security standard, which is not another protocol. It's almost a standard of standards. And so, if you want to interface with our platform, because there is a technical integration needed for the different protocols, if you want to interface with our platform, you have to adhere to this S3. Standard of standards, which is really just a common interface. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want underneath the covers. Obviously, we have to do a security audit of smart contract, and we have to do a review and ensure that it's properly following all the rules. But for us, we feel that S3 layer allows us to ensure that the securitized protocol and the Harbor protocol and the token self protocol are all sort of doing what they need to be doing. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to add a couple of additional features here and there, that's fine, because I think that's
kind of the bare minimum, right? You got to meet the S3 as the bare minimum, and then anything that you want to do, bells, whistles, whatever on top.
Exactly. So there, we've had a lot of informal discussions with the different issuance platforms, and there's interest in standardizing and just kind of coming to terms with if we can all agree on one protocol, then that should benefit everyone. But you start getting into, people put their names on protocols and no one wants to adopt their competitor's protocol. So that's something that's just going to take time. Ultimately, too, a lot of the, by our last count, there's over 80 issuance platforms out there that we've cataloged. Only a handful of them are active.
Yep.
And so I think the active protocols, the protocols that are in production today that are being used out in the wild already, ultimately, I think those will also be the ones that are going to really influence a lot of what the final protocol will look like, mm-hmm. simply because they're out in the wild, they're being vetted, they're being battle tested right now. And that's going to be, I think, a big attractive selling point across the board.
For sure. And then I guess the other piece of this is there's exchanges, mm-hmm. right? One of which you guys, I think you guys were the first to be up running and trading. And I should say,
clarification, we're not an exchange.
Okay.
It's a SEC reserve term. We're an ATS.
An ATS, okay.
Alternative trading system.
Describe what the difference is.
Yeah, so there are three tiers, if you will, in the broker-dealer you know, think of these like Pokemon, I think, if you will. You've got your base broker dealer that can transact in private securities, like these alternative assets, digital securities. Then you can upgrade your broker dealer to what's called an ATS, an alternative trading system, which is that next level. What the ATS allows you to do then as well is now other broker dealers could fit pipe into you. So think of it a little bit as a spoke and hub type model where the ATS, other broker dealers are able to pipe into it via APIs or fixed feeds to receive real-time quotes, put in automated orders, et cetera. And so then the third level, sort of the final level on top of that is the exchange. So a full-blown SEC registered exchange. At that level, there are a lot of similarities between an exchange and an ATS, but just to oversimplify it as a whole, an exchange is subject to much, much higher standards and reporting requirements and varying levels of different regulatory hurdles that they need to overcome. So for us, there is a future where we will move to that model when it makes sense. Right now, as an ATS, we are able to do a lot of the things that an exchange can do, but just it's a bit more a better fit for what we're trying to do within the industry.
Got it. And I should say as a disclaimer, obviously we're investors in Open Finance, and so a fan of what you're doing. Maybe describe where are we with ATS's exchange? Are there actually exchanges that are doing this? Is it all ATS's right now?
ATS's right now. Yeah, there's no. I mean, so again, like an ATS and exchange are very similar in certain regards. Just it is a much bigger undertaking to be a full-blown exchange. And quite frankly, just the industry is not there yet, right? So for us, we're an ATS. And so we have the ability to allow other broker-dealers to plug into us to effectively, you know, be e-trades to our NASDAQ, if you will, right? Where they can onboard their own clients and then through their trading interface, they can, send in automated orders, receive real-time price feeds, et cetera. There aren't really any broker dealers doing that right now. Mm-hmm. So to be a full blown exchange just doesn't make sense, right? I think you need right now as ATSs, there's only a handful of broker dealers that are out there that are actively working with these digital securities. And so on the ATS side, there's a handful of us out there. There's Open Finance, there's T0 is also active. They're only trading their own token. SharesPost is someone who's also done, they've done one live trade, and there's some others out there, but they, to our knowledge, they have not done a live trade yet, and are in varying stages of readiness.
Got it. Okay. And then, in terms of the, let's go back to the protocols for a second.
Yep.
What grade are you going to give protocols?
Incomplete.
Incomplete. Okay. All right. Not we haven't even taken the test yet. Okay.
We are just, some of these instruments just went live and we haven't, one of the challenges we were talking about one of our partners the other day was that there's a certain tokenized fund that we work with that is actively trading. Now that fund wants to do sort of a second tranche. And so now you need to, the smart contract layer needs to be able to handle, okay, you've got investors tokens from the shares from the first tranche. And they've been trading, there's different holding periods around, on the Reg D, Reg S side of when they can start trading, both in and out of the US. And now you're adding the second tranche layer that now shares from this second tranche, although they are the same underlying share class, they need to act a little bit differently because now these have a different timeline around them. Mm-hmm. So that it sort of restarts the clock for these particular shares. And so how do we manage that, right? I mean, how do you manage that sort of aspect? In the traditional world, what you would do is you would simply just not release the second tranche of shares to the shareholders until the holding periods had passed. And so you would kind of bypass any of that interim period by just withholding them. And obviously, that's not what we want to do collectively across the board. We want to be able to empower the investors, allow them to hold their tokens or store them in cold storage as they prefer. So that's something that's still being worked on. So mm-hmm. that's why I say incomplete, right? I mean, it's there's still a lot of factors that are being worked on as more and more edge cases start showing up that need to be handled properly.
What grade would you give the ATSs and exchanges?
Well, I would give us an A+. We are killing it across the board.
That's like if the teacher took the test, right?
Yeah. I had the answer guide next to me.
So yeah.
All off. I think across the board, as a whole, I would, I'd put us at a B minus.
B minus. Yeah, okay.
Across the board, I think the one thing we talk about a lot with some of the other ATSs out there is how do we pull our liquidity together? Because there's not any one of us that has just like a massive pool of liquidity just yet. And so in order for us to really catalyze growth in the industry, we feel that there's a need to really pull these pockets together in a way that now we can increase the distribution and the eyeballs in the audience that see these type of tokenized offerings. That to me is really the only way that collaborative, what do they call it? Collaboration or something? What is it?
Collaboration.
And not collaboration, where it's like collaboration with your competition.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
There's a fancy
frenemies.
Like that. Yeah.
But so that's my sentiment that in early days we need to do that. We need to pull liquidity together in order to make it work. And so there, I still think we're a B minus just because there's been a lot of talks of that, but we haven't actually pulled together and put that. Yeah. Individually for us, I'll give us an A. I think there's room for improvement. A minus. I think we're doing a lot of things right. I think we could do a lot of other things better.
What's the number one thing that you're like, you wake up in the middle of the night and you're just like, man, we suck at doing this. We got to get better at X.
I think, honestly, I we are hampered to a certain extent by how the regulations and how we can talk about what we're doing. I think that's one thing we need to work on. And it's not we need to do better marketing. I think it's more just because I think our marketing's killing it. I think it's more we need to understand how to better communicate the value proposition of what we're doing to our audience and also to, not even just to our audience of folks who are already active in crypto, because I think that's easy enough, right? You know, you can push out content to crypto channels, but the real growth is going to come from mainstream adoption. So we need to really detail out what is the value proposition for a mainstream investor. Why would someone who, or even a traditional alternative asset investor, right? Why would somebody who's accustomed to buying these assets on paper, if you will? I mean, certainly for us in the room, it's easy to say, oh, of course you want to digitize, you know, your investment holdings. But we say that because we're very techno savvy and we kind of like are very excited and caught up in this little bubble, if you will. But how do you get a mainstream traditional investor excited about the opportunities here? How do you communicate to them that this is a better instrument for you? And not even just the instrument itself, this is a better format for you. That's what I think we need to do better. And quite frankly, across the board, I think as a whole, the industry needs to do better on that to try to really increase the pie, because otherwise we're all just fighting for that same little pie slices.
Yeah, makes sense. Service providers. So we'll just lump in accounting, legal, auditing, kind of everything together, which is probably unfair to a number of people, but we only have so much time to talk. Walk through kind of where do you see in that service provider bucket the most important aspect or two, and then we can get into what you think the grade is.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to go with lawyers as the most important factor.
I thought you were gonna
say. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because just had this conversation yesterday too that there are folks out there who are saying they're blockchain lawyers, and you're like, well, what does that mean? What does that actually? There's no new law for blockchain per se, and so for us, it's the securities lawyers that are kind of savvy enough to recognize sort of this new technological format and how it applies to existing securities laws. Those are the folks that to us are critical to kind of educate more and more of the securities lawyers to this new format so that they can take it forward to their clients and or when their clients approach them and say, you know, we've been hearing a lot about digitized assets. Is this something for us? Could this be appropriate for us? The lawyer can actually then give them a educated response instead of a, I don't know, I'll go ask our new 22-year-old, you know, intern or whatever who is more tech savvy than I am, right? We need to have that education sort of at the front line, because the securities lawyers are at the front line of all of these new offerings coming out, and sort of, you know, even before they start doing an offering, you know, the first thing you do is go talk to your securities lawyer. Yep. The first thing you should do is go talk to your securities lawyer. So I think that's the most sort of, that's the most important layer of service providers. Accountants, I think, is also pretty critical in a sense of, especially as you start dealing with the Reg D, Reg S combinations that are very popular today, there's a lot of implications around selling outside of the US and in terms of tax withholdings and whatnot that aren't necessarily being accounted for properly today. And I think it'll flush out over time, but people have kind of just been sweeping it under the rug right now because they're like, oh, that's an end of year thing. We'll deal with that when we get there. And I think it's something that's going to potentially bite a lot of the issuers in a way that could hamper growth because it's going to leave a bad taste in their mouth and they're not going to be interested perhaps in doing a second offering in a tokenized format.
Got it. Okay. And then what do you think about the assets themselves, right? The assets seem to be, we just went through kind of the ecosystem, if you will, right? So everything from the issuance platforms, the protocols, the exchanges and the service providers, they're all, in my opinion, going to live or die with the quality and the demand for the assets, right? What are you seeing in terms of the types of assets and maybe even which ones are being successful and then which ones are just falling flat on their face and failing?
Yeah. We're seeing stuff across the board, like venture capital funds, hedge funds, real estate, private companies, revenue sharing models of like new product lines. It's right now everyone's struggling across the board to raise capital, but this the what we believe to be a winning formula, which is going to sound obvious when I say it, is sort of a marquee name putting out a high quality product. And so we think real estate is just well suited for this type of, you know, real estate in general is well suited for fractional ownership. I think it's an asset that people generally understand across the board. Everyone knows that real estate is a critical component of a well-balanced portfolio, a well-diversified portfolio. And so if you can, have a marquee name that's offering some sort of a downtown New York office building, for example, like that I believe is a product that will do very well because people will understand that. They'll understand the hard asset that is under the offering and they'll have a place for it in their portfolio. The more exotic stuff that we're seeing, a lot of new sort of brand new companies per se that are very unproven, this is almost like their Series A that they're trying to raise. I think those are going to have a really hard time right now because you've already got this exotic format of tokens and then you've got this exotic underlying asset as well that just it's a hard sell. You have to cross two hurdles. So, Blockchain Capital, they did a tokenized offering of one of their venture capital funds that did very well. They're a name in the industry where people recognize them and they kind of recognize the management team behind it. They know that they have a successful track record. And so if they were to do another fund offering, I believe it would do well as well. We're starting to see some real estate offerings. Harbor is working on a private REIT right now. That seems to be have good reception in the market. And so real estate, I think, is going to be that big driver because I think it's just something people really understand. And so then you remove that exotic asset offering element of it. And now you just have to get people across the hurdle of this is just the same real estate you've invested in before. Now just an improved digital format.
What's the number one asset? If you could pick any asset in the world, you were like, if we tokenize X, there would be like that would be your dream.
I got to go with real estate.
What piece of real estate? Yeah, like the actual asset itself. Which one would you pick?
There's like a big marquee name. Let's say, for example, in Chicago, if they were to tokenize the Sears Tower, something like that, like refinance the Sears Tower or something to that extent, that I think, I mean, people would recognize that worldwide. I mean, that's a landmark building.
Yep.
It would have that broad name recognition. And then quite frankly, so long as the underlying offering, the economics are sound, like I think that's an easy sell. And so that to me, I say an easy sell just because that appeals to a wider audience of participants and what's in the market today. The folks that are in the market today, some of them perhaps invested in ICOs back in the day or they've done Bitcoin and Ethereum. So they're kind of used to that exotic element of it. But again, to my earlier point, for us to really grow the market, we need to have more mainstream adoption. Mm-hmm. And so a marquee name, something that people immediately recognize, give them that sense of stability, confidence, and trust. I think something like that will be a watershed moment in the industry.
Got it. And then what about regulators, right? Obviously, you've spent a bunch of time both just kind of in getting your own regulatory licensing, et cetera. And then also, I'm sure a lot of regulators have wanted to just understand what's going on. What have you found maybe they're most curious about or learning about? And then also, what's their reception to this whole digital security space?
Yeah, it's been a lot of education in a good way, in a good way. I think there is a lot of, there's been a lot of back and forth conversations that we've had around properly conveying how these digital securities interact, how they're different than what's been done before, and also how they're very much the same as what's been done before. And so for us, we had the benefit of having an operational business already that was doing exactly what we're doing today, just non-blockchain. And so we were able to really, you know, we had our policies and procedures from how we do this on paper, if you will. And we were able to walk the regulators through that and then almost show them a red line version of, and here's how we're doing it on the digital side now. And so a lot of that just kind of being able to relay back and forth at like, okay, here's how we did it in the traditional space. And this is how we've all kind of understood that it's okay to be done. And here you'll note here that instead of using some sort of transfer agent or fund administrator or something like that, we're using someone, a service provider that is the books and records keeper on chain, if you will. So one of these issuance platforms, you know, serves as a digital registrar to a lot of these issuers. So similar to a transfer agent or a fund administrator. And so kind of being able to show sort of the old way and the new way side by side, I think was really beneficial and kind of was helpful in educating kind of how these digital securities are different. And then more importantly, why they're better, right? Yep. I think for us, a big thing that we talk about is it's because you can code a lot of the rules and regulations at the smart contract layer, you can actually ensure that they're being enforced across the board in a way that was never able to be done before. So you explain that to the regulators and now they can actually, without having to sift through mountains of paperwork, they can actually see that these offerings are adhering to the rules and the regulations and the process and enforcing investor protection at a much higher level than was possible before. That to us is sort of like a huge boon to the regulators, because also at the end of the day, they're out for the protection of the, you know, Main Street investor, if you will, mm-hmm. the mom and pops out there who want access to these types of offerings for their portfolio. You know, just have to ensure that they're protected. And so the technology allows the regulation to be enforced in a much better fashion.
We've talked a lot about kind of equity ownership, right? Whether it's in companies, in funds, or in real estate. Yep. What are you seeing in the debt markets, right? Debt's a huge asset class in the traditional markets, but what are you seeing in this digital security space for debt?
There's been a handful of debt instruments that we've seen come across our desks. It's haven't seen too much at a for us debt is really just because of some of the long-term aspects of it. You really need to have an entity behind it that is high level and trustworthy. Like it can't be sort of a new operation per se. So we haven't seen any institutional level type players step forward with debt offerings, but we think, I mean, similar to the early crowdfunding days, we like to call this stuff crowdfunding 2.0, if you will, but early crowdfunding days, like debt-based instruments took off significantly because you had these entities that were taking traditional real estate product, for example, and offering, you know, debt instruments off of that. And so haven't seen too much of that yet, but we think it's going to be a big growth area in the market.
Got it. Is there any area that people aren't talking about that you're like, look, this is either a huge opportunity or you're actually seeing quite a lot of assets and activity and just people haven't caught on to it yet?
Yeah, I think just traditional, like limited partnerships that are out there, just like these traditional vehicles where people are in these for, you know, 10 or so years. We think that's an area that no one's really looking at just mm-hmm. yet. And we think there's a lot of pent up liquidity sort of demand there where you've got these participants who have been in these instruments for a very long time. And these are solid, well-performing instruments. And to give those participants the option of liquidity, we think is going to be an area that will be a good conduit towards more institutional product. We haven't really seen anyone focus on that just yet. And so that's an area that we think could be focused on.
Got it. Before I wrap up, I always do rapid fire questions. Yeah. What is the most important company in crypto other than your own?
I will go with, I'll go with Bakkt, actually.
Bakkt.
Yeah.
B-A-K-K-T.
K-K-T. Yeah. I think they're going to, on the regulatory side, they're going to push the envelope much further than companies like ours can do, simply because they have much larger financial backing. And so they're able to kind of really push the needle forward on the regulatory side, I think will benefit all other participants in the market. And so they'll be the ones out there, you know, advocating and lobbying, you know, in Washington to really push for a refresh of some of these securities laws and the regulation in place. And I say refresh, it's not a redo, it's not a rewrite, it's just refreshing them to account for this new distributed format.
Got it. That makes sense. What do you think is your most controversial thought in crypto? What do you believe that a high majority of other people would disagree with?
So a lot of people are struggling with the fact that these security tokens, I think they're not bearer assets anymore. I think people have that mentality of, you know, you've got your Bitcoin, you've got your Ethereum, you can hold it in your wallet and no one can take that away from you. And the way a lot of these security tokens are being coded is there actually are, for regulatory and legal reasons, there are ways to kind of claw them back if you need to. And so I think that's something that a lot of people aren't, they feel like kind of goes against the spirit of blockchain, because it almost kind of brings back that centralized aspect of it. But to me, I think that's something that needs to be done sort of in this first phase. And then as we move to the second phase, then we can kind of revisit that aspect of sort of, you know, autonomous ownership, if you will. But that's something that, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, people saying, oh, is this inherently contradictory to the spirit of distributed ledger technology?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, part of it too, right, is, you know, think of cell phones, for example. It would have been great to go from landlines to smartphones.
Right.
But in between, actually, people carried around a suitcase that had a phone in it, right? And then they went to like the big bricks, and then they went to like a flip phone. And then eventually we got the smartphones. And
that's
so
funny. Yeah, that's
there's some evolution that has to happen.
Yeah, we'll look back at this time and be like, man, can you believe our phones were like this big? Can you believe digital securities were this clunky at first, and until they got evolved into that next phase?
When I was a kid, I've actually never told a story before. When I was a kid, I was probably, I don't know, 8-9 years old. And I remember I got in a car, and I actually can't remember, was it a car that like my dad had rented, or was it like a friend's car or something? Yeah. But I remember the first time I saw like a landline looking phone.
Yeah.
In the car.
Oh,
right. Like you could like pick up the phone and had the cord, and like you could talk in the car on the phone, whatever. And I remember just being like, whoa.
Yeah.
Right. And now we walk around with computers in our pocket. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to have one of those like T-Mobile Sidekick type phones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Had the slide out keyboard. I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the best phones ever.
Yeah.
all right. What one regulation would you change or improve if you could?
I'll go obscure here. I'll go Section 12G.
Okay, what is that?
So Section 12G.
You're the first person to ever name the regulation by official name. All right, what is that?
It's on page 38, line number 40. So Section 12G is sort of a, it does a variety of things, but it puts a cap on the number of shareholders that certain private companies can have. It used to be 500. You could have no more than 500 shareholders, and they bumped it up to 2,000 for private companies. But to us, if you read sort of the spirit and the intent of what the rule is, it's to, again, investor protection, that once a company gets to a certain number of shareholders, in theory, they cannot properly manage / communicate with their shareholder base well enough in a way that the shareholders will be protected. So at that point, you have to go public. And then there's a very onerous process for that, or a very burdensome process. And so for us, with this new technology, you can streamline and properly communicate and manage relationships with those, with more than 2,000 shareholders if you needed to. And so we think that's one that if you look at what the spirit and the intent of Section 12G is, we think that's one that is ripe for refreshing, especially as more and more companies seek to remain private longer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the lines between public and private are going to kind of completely blur?
There won't
be a private company and a public company in the future. It'll just be there are companies and there's liquidity options associated with what the company wants.
I, you look at some of these tokenized offerings out there today, and they're pseudo public in the sense of, you know, Blockchain Capital puts out a NAV every week. They update their NAV every week, and people have this visibility now into the companies, into these tokenized offerings in a way that they never did before, right? I mean, with traditional private securities, maybe you get an update from the GP or the issuer once a quarter, once a year, depending on how active they are. And so you look at some of these new offerings and the data that's available to you now, just the transparent nature of distributed ledger technology allows for the investor to have greater insight into what's happening with the company and how it's performing. Mm-hmm. And so they're already pseudo public, I think. And so it just kind of then depends on what tier are you at, right? Are you just getting started? And so your reporting requirements are really low. So you're down here all the way up to your NASDAQ level, and obviously you have very stringent reporting and other requirements you have to adhere to. And so depending on the needs of your company and where you're at in the full sort of a capital raising life cycle, you select a level that's right for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that it just gives the issuers, the entrepreneurs, the companies a lot more flexibility and options in terms of how they raise capital and how they can access these varying capital markets.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. What's the most important book you've ever read?
That's a tough one. I'll be honest, I've not read a book in a while. I have. The Content Little Baby is the most recent book I've read.
What is that?
Now I have a 9-month-old at home.
Oh.
And so the only actual reading I've been doing lately is around baby books. Uh-huh.
What's the one thing that having a child has like been the biggest surprise? What did you not expect?
I don't know if it's a surprise. I think to me, it just prioritized things differently. In a sense of, in my spare time, I would, do things that were more, perhaps more of my personal interests or hobbies and stuff. And so you learn to kind of prioritize different things now, because obviously Riley, my daughter, I now, instead of, doing things that might have been like a personal hobby, I'd rather just spend time hanging out with Riley at home and just playing around with her. She's starting to crawl and she started to pull herself up and kind of shuffle around now. It's like that to me is so much more exciting than finding time to read books per se. Haven't been able to do that. So I don't know that it's been a surprise. I think as a first time parent, we knew what we knew and we didn't know what we didn't know. But I think it's been something that's just been really challenging, rewarding, and just like a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
The baby on the move imagery in my head of like a baby crawling around the floor while you're trying to read is probably not something that gives parents a calm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun though.
All right. So two non-crypto questions. Okay. How long do you dunk Oreos in milk?
I like to let them get really soft.
Oh my God. That's a psychopath move.
No, I'll take a mug, like a wide mug, and just put a bunch of Oreos in there and come back like 5 to 10 minutes later and they're all mushy. And it's just it's like cereal. Yeah.
And so, it's like cereal?
Yeah, it's a little weird.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's the worst answer we've ever had.
I was like, some people are like, go real crazy. Like, oh, I dunk it for 15 seconds. You leave it for minutes?
I just let them, yeah.
And you just eat them really mushy? Like,
yeah.
All right.
It's like Oreo. It's not even cereal at that point, I guess. It's just,
yeah. Oh man, we got a lot to talk about. all right, and then what about aliens? Believer, non-believer, real, not real?
I think I'm a believer in the sense of it's a very big universe, and I think it's a little self-centered to think that we're the only life out there. Beyond that, I don't know what it looks like, right? I mean, I don't think it's going to be.
Are you scared of them?
No. I think, in what sense,
would you rather go to the depths of the ocean, which we know nothing about really, or would you rather go to space, which we think we actually know a lot about?
I'd rather go to space.
Space.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. To me, I look at like what Elon is doing, and like, I think my daughter's going to live on Mars one day. Like,
that's,
I think that's
crazy.
That's going to be like the up and coming neighborhood, right? You could live in like, instead of people moving to like You know, some of the key cities out there, you know, like today, like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, people sort of in that region gravitate towards those hubs. I think
people are like, I'm going to leave Chicago and go to Mars.
Well, I think, you know, for the same reason that people come to these hubs for like opportunities, right? I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities in these different outposts, you know, when it comes in 20 years from now. And I think people will flock to it simply for the opportunities to be part of that first wave and to be able to capitalize on a lot of those opportunities that are popping up of, you know, from a professional perspective or from a just I guess scientific or just exploratory perspective. But yeah, I think I'd much rather go to space and then deep underwater.
Yeah, the ocean kind of scares me a little bit.
It's a little, yeah.
Like what's down there?
Yeah.
Like you might find like a sunken ship with treasure, or you might find a sea monster that we don't know about.
Yeah, but see, that's less. It's not like we're going to find Atlantis, right? Like if there was a possibility that Atlantis was down there, like that would be exciting to me, because then you could, to me, the civilization that might have evolved from there could be
the aspect of adventure and discovery to you is more exciting of like Mars, space, yeah, the unknown, than like down in the ocean. It's just we're not going to find anything.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like you're right. I mean, there's certain pockets down there that we don't know much about, but we're not going to uncover something that's like, oh, hey, there's a whole nother world down here. So,
yeah.
All right, that's fair.
Yeah.
What one question do you have for me to end it?
Does everyone call you Pomp? Like, does anyone ever call you just like, hey, Anthony, aside from your mom, does your mom call you Anthony, or does your mom call you?
My mom actually doesn't even call me Anthony. So growing up, I think I was in like kindergarten or something, and I couldn't write my name. Like, dumbass me literally couldn't figure out how to write A-N-T-H-O-N-Y. Yeah. And so my mom was like, oh, just write your initials. And so my name is Anthony John Pompliano. Okay. And so she's like, just write AJ. And I was like, whew, went from, you know, a bunch of letters to just two. This is fantastic. And like, if you think of Anthony or AJ, A and the J are actually just like straight lines. You just have to connect them. Like, yeah, it's like pretty easy letters to write. And so I started writing it. And literally through high school, pretty much all of my friends called me AJ.
Okay.
And my mother, my father, everyone, all my brothers, AJ. And Anthony only came out when I was in trouble. Oh. And so when I got to college, a little bit in high school, people had called me Pomp, but really in college, people started to call me that. And the reason why it was hard through high school was I have four younger brothers. And so usually there was two of us, whether we were playing sports, we were doing, like, we were all together at some point, and we rarely did things alone. So if you yelled out Pomp, you'd get like two or three people to turn around.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really work for names. And so when I got to college for a couple of years, I was there by myself without any of my brothers. And so Pomp started to take hold. And I literally couldn't lose the nickname at this point if I tried. Yeah. Like, people get mad at me at conferences or at an event or something if I introduce myself as Anthony.
Yeah.
And then somebody else will say like, hey, Pomp. And the first person would be like, dude, what the hell? Like, nobody knows you as Ant. Like, you have to introduce yourself as Pomp, because that's how everyone knows you. And so it's weird. Like,
it's the first time I wrote you an email, I was like,
do you say Anthony or Pomp?
I was like, do I, you know, you start with the name, comma, and then you write your messages. Like, do I write Pomp? Or I think I may have used Anthony, just because I didn't really know you back then. I was like, is that presumptuous to just jump in on the nickname to start calling him Pomp? And so
I realized everyone calls you Pomp.
Literally to the point where my mother even laughs about it now, right? Like, she's just like, well, how the heck did this happen? And I think my brothers are the funniest, right? They're just like, you know, how did it go from Anthony Pompliano, which is like one of the most Italian, you know, long names you can have, to just four letters.
Yeah.
Right. And so, so we get a good laugh out of it. But names are weird, because in crypto specifically, like, if you think of even Twitter, like, how many, like, I literally see at conferences, people will put their first name on like a name badge, and then they'll put like @ and then whatever their Twitter handle is.
Yeah.
Or people will come up to me and they'll introduce themselves and they're like, hey, and whatever the Twitter handle is.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't even tell me your name. You literally told me your Twitter handle. And it's like, that becomes like such an
idea. 2020.
Well, it just becomes this like identifier.
Yeah.
Because if you're on Twitter a lot, like, that's what you engage with. You actually don't engage with the person as a name. You engage with their Twitter handle.
Your Twitter handle is not Pomp.
It is not.
It's like a Pomp or something.
I tried to get it one time. big issues. There's a guy, I think he...
call him Jack and just have him.
No, listen, I think there's this guy, if I remember correctly, he's like a DJ in Texas or something. I actually think he blocked me at this point.
Oh, did he really?
Well, because everyone kept accidentally tags him. Yeah. They just like at Pomp, and they tag him. And so I messaged him one time. I was like, hey man, like, would you give it up? And he was just like, he basically kick rocks, right? Like he was like, no way.
Is he even using it?
Well, so he is, he's like a radio DJ.
Oh.
So like, and I think his name is like DJ Pomp or something. And I was like, oh man, you're stealing my thunder. Like my DJ career.
These are great April Fool's jokes somewhere in there. Are you guys switch Twitter handles for a day?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, if we switch, I'm not giving it back. So I'll warn him right now. Don't give me that Twitter handle. You're not getting it back. All right, man. Listen, thank you so much for doing this. This is awesome. I think people really appreciate hearing kind of a state of digital securities, and we'll have to do it again in a few months.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey everyone, Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.